Hello and welcome to the First Take Film Club. I'm your host, Connor Norcott, and today, as always, I'm joined by these two wonderful fellas, Liam Jones and Luke Chandley. Luke, how are you doing, man?
Yeah, really good, thanks. Yeah, really, really good. We're doing like a late night episode, like when Hollyoaks goes like after like 9 p.m. It's going to be a bit like that, so it might be a bit wild and racy. No, it's purely because of the time constraints of just of our lives. But yeah, I'm doing really good, and I'm actually like really excited. Obviously, I wasn't on last week's episode because I had the vaccine, and it just like literally just knocked my head off. Like it was such a weird situation because obviously, like, I was just sat there, like, I had the height of the flu, like, I felt awful. But then also, like, in the back of my mind was just like, oh, well, I've got the vaccine, this is great, isn't it? So, like, it was never, ever really, like, it was really bad and I didn't feel great, but, you know, it's good to be, like, yeah, 24 hours and I'm boxed. So, yeah, so I'm really, really good, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, man, I'm good. I feel like you said, it feels a bit strange to be doing this late. Normally, when we start off, we always say that, oh, yeah, I'm kind of tired because we normally record in the morning, but, like, it's 11 o'clock and I feel a bit knackered. If Liverpool hadn't won tonight, which I swear we won't talk about it too much, but if they hadn't won tonight, I think I would have been miserable, to be honest. But yeah, I'm okay. How about you, Liam? How are you doing?
Good, mate. I got through the door from work 20 minutes ago. It's been a bit of a rush. So, yeah, I'm kind of decompressing now, having a beer and talking to you guys. So, you know, what more do you want?
Sounds like a nice Saturday night. You know what? It has been a bit of a weird one, hasn't it? Because I feel like you said, it does feel a bit like when Hollyoaks goes rogue. We're past the watershed. Me and Liam are both having a beer. It's somehow really hot in my flat and it's like 11 p.m. and I don't really know what's going on. I feel like I'm in this weird spin-off episode where everything's going wrong, but we're just gonna have to make it work. So if you listen to the podcast, which of course you do, you listen to this one, you'll know that we always start with an opening question. And I'll be honest, we've been a bit lax with this week. And I just really want to know, what have you boys been watching?
I've rewatched Partridge, like the first series of Iron Man Partridge this week. Actually, that's not even a film, so I probably shouldn't have led with that. But
talk about it.
That was really good because just Partridge is just absolutely hilarious. But I watched last night. Was it last night? Some night of my life. I watched Raya and the Last Dragon, the new Disney animation film, and it's just really meh. Like, I think the problem is, I was hoping that it was going to be like Moana, which is just chock full of absolute bangers, and it just had like no music. So I was just disappointed, really, to be honest with you. But I think that's all I've watched recently that's like new that I haven't watched before, apart from the film we're doing today. So yeah, not a lot.
On to yourself then, Liam, because I feel like I've watched everything and anything, this week. I want to know what you've been watching.
So I've had a really weird one. I haven't watched many films. I've been watching Line of Duty. I've caught up with that, which is great. Mm-hmm. I watched the last episode. I don't know if anyone's heard of a TV show on ITV called Unforgotten, which is really, really like, it's really heartbreaking. But it's similar to Line of Duty in that it's about UK coppers but they deal with historic crimes. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting, but it's really sad. I tell you what, though, I watched about 4 nights ago, I couldn't sleep, and it popped up on right at the top of Disney Plus, in like the top banner, the first banner. I thought, why are they promoting this? They must be desperate for people to watch it. It was the 2014 or 2015 version of Fantastic Four. And I'd heard it was bad, right? I'd heard it was bad. And I thought to myself, surely it isn't as bad as people say. Like, surely it can't be the worst superhero movie ever that's been made. And it is. I swear to God, it is the most dumb. It doesn't make any sense. Whoever edited it needs firing from everything ever. Terrible. I swear to God, it doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. It's like, for some reason, for a reboot superhero movie as well, it's only 90 minutes long. Doesn't make any sense because you've got to do like the origins of the Fantastic Four, which so they spend the first hour and 10 minutes of the film, they've not even gone to the place where they get the powers. So then you're left with like half an hour of like, right, so they've got to get the powers and they've got to learn how to cope with the powers, and then they've got to defeat Dr. Doom in like 20 minutes.
Oh, is Dr. Doom in that?
Oh, that's so disappointing, because Dr. Doom's like an actual boss, like guy as well.
I swear to God, I don't know what they were smoking when they designed Dr. Doom. It's awful. Dr. Doom looks so trash. Like, I swear to God, any one of us boys could create a better and more kind of, you know, intimidating character. I swear to God, it's awful. It is so bad. And then I wanted to remember, you know, how I felt watching Fantastic Four when I was a kid. So I put on Rise of the Silver Surfer, mm-hmm. Which I loved when I was a kid. And I have to say, is also trash. But but I feel like those films, they're self-aware in the sense that they know they're a bit shit and a bit cheesy. Mm-hmm. So I kind of like was on board a little bit. But, oh, mate, and they sexualize the hell out of Jessica Alba. So it's kind of like, in this day and age, uncomfortable to watch, to be quite honest.
That's the Silver Surfer one.
Yeah, and like Silver Surfer is such a dope character.
Yeah,
he's
man,
such
I love
a,
that as
he's
well.
so cool. And they don't quite fulfill that character's potential. Anyway, Connor, what have you been watching?
I don't think I've watched anything as bad, but I have definitely watched things that are a bit like, oh fuck, are we really watching this? Have you boys heard of a film called Fatal Attraction, the Michael Douglas movie?
Oh yeah,
that is unbelievable, and it's kind of shit, right? But it's like once again, one night I couldn't sleep, and I listened to this other film podcast that I won't give them any free publicity. I won't name them, but they did an episode maybe about a year ago on Fatal Attraction, and I thought, I'll maybe give it a listen. And the first five minutes of the build up to the episode made me think, oh, maybe I'll watch the movie. And I checked it out, and it is one of the most batshit crazy things I've ever seen. And it's amazing. And I think Michael Douglas might be someone that we need to bring on the podcast. Maybe hopefully as a guest sometime, obviously, but I more mean like we need to do some Michael Douglas films, because that man goes for it all the time.
Glenn Close is fucking great in that film as well, though.
She's also going for it, you know? Like, I think they're batting at the same average in that film.
Yeah,
I wouldn't know if I'd go as far as great, but her movie, man. It's her
she
movie.
Brings it. She brings the crazy. She does crazy well. Like, mm-hmm. she is great. I know it's a bit of a... It's very different, but her Cruella de Vil is fucking brilliant. It's so good.
I'm not
that, man. You've not seen the live-action 101 Dalmatians?
That was never really my bag. I was a big, I kind of liked, I was watching, you know, socio-realist films when I was like three, Ken Loach when I was a kid. That really hardened me.
Oh God, I feel sorry.
Growing up on the streets of Ballycastle, that's what made me the man I am. Anyway, moving on before we talk about anything more tragic and depressing. The film that we're covering this week is, of course, 12 Angry Men, the Sidney Lumet directorial debut, believe it or not, from 1957. And this was a first take for both Liam and yourself, Luke, wasn't it? Yeah. So before we start, I'll just give a quick little piece of like information and a synopsis or whatever on the film. So it centers around 12 members of a jury who must decide whether or not they think a boy is guilty of killing his father. And it's, you know, it's relatively straightforward in terms of plot details, but instead it kind of takes its time and forms, you know, kind of forms an almost ensemble character study, and the details are revealed through discussion and debate, and ultimately the decision is made at the end of the 90 minutes. We need to do more 90-minute films on the podcast. Anyway, look, it was your first take. Let me know what you think. What did you think?
Yeah, oh man, I love this film so much. Like, I just loved it. I think because we've done like kind of older films, you know, we have done some older films on the podcast before, and I think I've probably the first one we did, I was just not stoked on it all, I imagine, because I'm just like more of like a new blockbuster guy a lot of the time. But then I know up to this point, like, I was quite excited just to dig in and see what it was about. Like, I didn't really, I'd kind of heard of it, and I remember we spoke about doing it on the podcast, I mean, like, probably for quite a few months now, and it's kind of popped his head up every now and again. Mm-hmm. And I just like hadn't engaged in the conversation because I didn't really know what it was, and after watching it, like I just stuck it on, and within 10, 15 minutes, I was like fully engaged, like thrown down, like engaged, like really loving it. I feel like I don't want to peek here too much, but I definitely think it's in like my top three first takes that I've ever like done on this podcast. I say I love films a lot or I hate films a lot, but I just adore this film, which I feel slightly different. Like I really like it, but I'm not like buzzing off it in terms of like, I don't know, you know, you can be sometimes off films where you're like proper buzzing off it, but I'm just like, I'm going to watch that 10 times in the next 10 years. You know, I just know it. I just proper loved it. I thought, well, that's just going straight in there in my like bank of films to watch in future. I loved it.
On to yourself then, Liam, because it was also a first take for yourself. What did you think? What did you make of it?
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Mm.
It is good. It's
good. That.
Yeah, no, it is a brilliant film. The concept in itself is kind of genius, right? To have these 12 angry men in one room for a whole film. Logistically, you know, it seems simple, but it's actually not. You know, to do something like that in one room for 90 minutes of film, it is genius. It is absolutely fantastic. And you know what I thought of when I was watching it? It reminded me a lot of Do the Right Thing, you know, with the whole, you know, the heat in the room, and everyone's sweating and the tensions are rising. And I would be surprised if Spike Lee wasn't inspired a little bit by that film. Yeah. When making Do the Right Thing. But yeah, honestly, it's great. And I love that you manage in 90 minutes to get a kind of a little deep dive into kind of each character. You know, by the end of the film, by the time the film finishes, you know each character almost. You know what they are and probably a little bit of what they've been through and why they are the way they are and why they are giving their opinions and why they were so quick to send the lad to his death. Mm-hmm. And I just think that in itself is kind of brilliant. So yeah, 100%. I love this film to bits. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm glad it's finally came to the podcast, because I feel like my mum, who is definitely listening to this, is like the biggest fan of this. And has been begging me, Dad, you gotta do 12 Angry Men on the pod. So, Mom, if you're listening, I hope you're happy now. You can get your next recommendation in another 2 years' time. But I don't know. I feel like when I was deciding to come to Liverpool and study film, and I wanted to, you know, when I was starting to get involved with film anyway, my Aunt Lisa, who probably isn't listening to this, but if you are, Lise, big up, she put me onto this film. And she's always been kind of the person who's recommended little bits. Oh, well, if you like that, maybe try this, maybe try that. And it must have been about 15 when she told me to watch it. And even then, when you're 15, you're not a very emotionally intelligent person. I don't think you're a very self-aware person. At least I wasn't. But even then, I think it already kind of affected me. And it kind of, and since then, my relationship with the film has kind of evolved as I've gotten older. So watching it again for this podcast, it felt kind of special, man. Like I maybe watched it about 6 weeks before we did this episode. And I posted like a little Letterboxd review saying that like, it's one of those films that I think will always be around my top 10, top 15 films ever, just for the impact it had on me. But every single time I watch it, there's just something more enjoyable about it. It's kind of like, we always talk about this thing where once you know the twist of a film and you go back and watch it, it's kind of fun watching them all play out. Well, there's not as many twists in this, but you kind of know the lines. And like Liam talked about, you know the characters, and the characters are so important that when they have their moment, whether it's a horrible racist rant or someone turning around and saying, actually, you know, no, not guilty. Or the old man, the old juror who I fucking love to bits, that guy. Anything he does, you know, every single little moment like that. I love this film. And it was kind of something I hadn't really seen before, because like I said, when you're young, you're watching films that are really big, plot heavy, explosive, Jurassic Park kind of awesome blockbuster movies, which I love too. But seeing how, you know, Sidney Lumet was able to kind of tell a story just through character and dialogue and discussion, it really caught me off guard. And I want to know, did it do the same to you? I'll come to you first. Look, what did you make of that?
Did it catch me off guard? I don't think so. I think when you like, when we do these films, and like, I think mainly, I imagine it might be the same for you guys, like you look at the length, and it's mainly just to be like, hey, when am I going to kind of watch this? Like, you know, can I fit it in like, when am I going to have to sit down and watch it? Mm-hmm. And like, when you hit like a 90 minute film that's supposed to be really, really good, then like, I was intrigued anyway, because it was kind of like, I don't see how you, almost like what Liam said about, not comparing the two, what a Fantastic Four, you've almost got like this, you've got the arc of the film somehow, and you've got to get, mm-hmm. you've got to get from baseline up and over the arc into the end. And the reason that 90 minute films don't happen very often is because that's really, really hard to do. So I was kind of like intrigued to be like, okay, it's about a jury, and they're obviously going to be discussing this case. And I don't know if there's going to be more scenes outside of the jury discussion, which obviously there wasn't. But I was very much like, it wasn't the case that it caught me off guard. I just kind of didn't really know how it was going to go about, what it went about. Obviously, I read the synopsis and was kind mm-hmm. of intrigued then. Something that like I was going to jump in on earlier and decided not to, but something that really caught me off guard, but in a really good way, is when you were discussing like the dialogue, getting to know the characters, and like each, like there's no fat at all. Like every line matters in terms mm-hmm. of like, not like in terms of the plot itself, but like getting to know each character. And I suppose that's pretty surprising, because that, you know, that doesn't happen very often. Like you're kind of talking I said to Connor on our chat today, like it's not too far off like kind of perfect film territory, really, in terms of, yeah, people will have their opinions yay or nay or whatever, but I kind of felt that it was so tight, and there was I didn't see any negatives whatsoever. Like I just went through it from beginning to end and thought it was brilliant. So mm-hmm. I suppose surprising's a tough one to decide on, but it was just, it intrigued me. And then when I got in there, I kind of didn't have time to be surprised, because like it was just 90 minutes of like lean mm-hmm. chat, and like every mm-hmm. like, you know, from the way like people in sort of the 50s spoke, and the way they like interacted. And what I really loved was like the way that they, you know, I suppose nowadays, if they were to have a discussion or an argument or some different things were said personally in like a room of that size, then people would be shouting and effing and blinding. But it's really like quite humbling and wholesome to see them have like an actual just discussion. So mm-hmm. that was like, and I was watching that, and we discussed that when I was watching it, and we were just like, yeah, that's quite nice and surprising. So I think I've gone around the houses in terms of answering the question, but like that's what so surprised me or cut me off guard about the movie a bit.
Mm-hmm. I think normally when we do these episodes, we have like a, I wouldn't say a nailed on structure, but a rough guideline of these are the points we're going to hit, and these are the categories we're going to touch on. And normally they're, you know, when we start off talking about plot and stuff, it's all really easy to do, because there are scenes, there's big, you know, set pieces, or there's big moments. But in this film, it is quite intimate. It might touch on big themes, but it's quite small, quite self-contained. And obviously it is more or less all shot in one room. So in terms of how we're going to do this, it might be a bit scatterbrained, but we'll make it work. As it all kind of does progress through the characters and their interactions, I want to know, I'll come to yourself first, Liam, what stood out to you straight away about how Sidney Lumet and these actors all kind of put this film together, and how the plot kind of unraveled, I guess?
So, first of all, right, I watched this film this morning, then I went to work for 10 hours, right? And usually when I'm at work, it's a boring job. So I'll usually just kind of like sing songs in my head whilst I'm working, you know, to make time go by. But today, all I was thinking about with this film, really, it's a really affecting film. And in terms of the characters, I love how fundamentally in the end, you kind of have like this hero who is Henry Fonda, who's almost like, in the end, almost resembles almost like an angel, you know, the way when he's walking down the stairs at the end and he's in his white suit, and it's quite, you know, he is like, he's this boy's guardian angel. He's just saved his life, mm-hmm. you know. And then you've got Lee J. Cobb, who's Jorah 8, who's almost like the villain. Mm-hmm. He's the guy who, at the end, he's the only one who still has the guilty verdict. But even with that, it's not, you know, it's not sinister. You get a kind of in-depth almost look into why he's thinking that way, and it's to do with his relationship with his own son, who he probably is almost pushing his feelings onto this poor boy or man. He's an 18-year-old Latino man, mm-hmm. who is on trial for murder. And so yeah, you've got this villain, you've this hero, you've got a fella who kind of just goes with the crowd. You know, he only really voted. And then you've got another fella who just wants to get out as quickly as possible. So he'll just go with whatever he wants. You've got the guy who is meticulous in his thinking. He doesn't even sweat, you know, just like Prince Andrew. he doesn't even sweat until the end where he's pressed and he actually does sweat. Mm-hmm. So you know that he's actually chatting bollocks. I just think it's then you've got the old man who, like you said, Connor, he is a lovely character. You know, he's the first one to change his mind. He's the first one who Henry Fonda convinces, you know, to change their minds. And to be honest, I think as well, you know, then you have the bigger picture as well. When you come away from it and you think kind of fundamentally about like the justice system, if you want to get kind of deep on that, and you know, how these 12 men were responsible for the life or death of an 18-year-old man who may or may not have done something bad. And mm-hmm. I think what's interesting is Henry Fonda's perspective. His view is that, well, what if we're wrong and we're sending an 18-year-old man to his death? You know, he's been abused all his life. His mother died when he was young. His dad hits him, punches him with his fists every day. So why would we send him to his death? It's not fair. And I think what in terms of the writing, the script, I think what's really, 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 really well done is that at first, when Henry Fonda says not guilty and they ask him, you know, come on then, explain yourself. And he's really kind of like, he beats around the bush a little bit. He's like, oh, maybe, I don't know. Well, he might be innocent. I don't know. I don't know these things. I don't know. And you're like, oh, come on, you need to be more convincing than that. And then next minute, you know, he's got all these little cards in his back pocket. You know, he pulls out the knife that's the same knife as apparently the only knife in the area is the one that the boy supposedly used to kill his dad. And then Henry Fonda suddenly just wham, grabs the knife. He went out and bought a knife, the exact same one.
Mm-hmm.
He is the guy with all these cards up his sleeve, these tricks that kind of, as a viewer, we're like, oh, yeah,
yeah.
Go, like, well mm-hmm. done. Like, mm-hmm. you've took us by surprise. You're taking, you know, the characters by surprise. And yeah, just fundamentally, I think the character work in this is spot on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you can develop 12 characters in one room with no flashbacks or anything like that, just straight up one scene, one room, and you can develop and almost backstories into each character, I think that is fantastic writing, great direction, and then brilliant acting as well to carry mm-hmm. that forward. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, honestly, absolutely, like, in character point of view, spot on.
It's really strange, isn't it, when we have a film where, well, first of all of us are agreed that it's, you know, some of us might say almost faultless. I would say it is a perfect movie, but what is really interesting is just quickly, I want to talk about Henry Fonda, who plays Juror number 8. They never have any names except for right at the end, kind of. So what's really interesting to me, and I only really noticed this a couple watches in, is that he never ever says that the guy is innocent. He never wants them to say he's innocent. I think what he says is, well, I think it deserves a little bit of time. Like, it deserves a conversation. And the whole film's kind of about, it's really interesting because it is just the ultimate moral dilemma of, you get to decide whether someone potentially lives or dies. Well, not potentially, definitely lives or dies, because the punishment for this crime at the time was the electric chair, I think it was. So it's kind of all, it kind of poses the question about, you know, what's the value of human life? And I find that really interesting. And that's a big, 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 you know, moral conundrum to discuss in a 90 minute film, but it's able to be done through numerous, you know, numerous details. But the key thing that you both touched on, I think, is the characters and how they're done. And it's all about detail for me anyway. Every little character has specific details about them, or, you know, specific maybe lines of dialogue and stuff like this, that when these big moments happen, like you touched on the knife, that's kind of when you see another character is going to be one round. And he's not going to say, oh, he's innocent. He's going to say, oh, okay, well, maybe, you know what, if we can't prove this beyond reasonable doubt, I'm on Team Henry Fonda, and I think we all should be on Team Henry Fonda. So big moments then, because we're going to go all over the place with plot here, I think. You touched on the knife. What moment stuck out to you the most as like, oh, okay, this is awesome? Because for me, and I love this so much, is when, I think when they're trying to prove about the old man who apparently heard the murder happen, he lived below him or above him or something like this. And, you know, they kind of disprove this theory about, oh, we're taking 15 seconds to get to the door and see this or whatever. And what they do is they kind of prove that the old man, they kind of turned Lee Jacob, who plays juror number three, who's kind of the antagonist that Liam touches on, they kind of turn his own words against him. And because he's kind of the, you know, the champion for the guilty side, you see people kind of fall in line and think, oh, actually, maybe he's not. And that moment for me is one that I just love to bits. What about you guys? What moment stood out to you? I'll come to you, Luke. What did you think?
Think the stats. So as you like go through, obviously it's kind of almost like got every juror has got a moment where like they are convinced, and it's like, you know, it's really good, really, really well. But like if you think about that in a 90 minute film, that's, you've got like about 7 minutes or 8 minutes, I imagine. I haven't done the maths, but so everyone's got kind of like a little window or a little peek into of curiosity about like, oh well, actually, this does leave a little bit of doubt. And I think the best one for that is when they're discussing with, I was trying to see which juror it was then, and I can't really tell. I can't see whether it was juror one, maybe. Mm-hmm. But when the guy with the glasses who apparently doesn't sweat and then has like one solitary bead of sweat that comes down his
number
head.
Number four.
Yeah. Number four. Mm-hmm. I like that conversation. And I think it's because like, you know, some of the jurors are convinced pretty easily, and it's about their background and the background of the accused, or it's about kind of like where a particular person's come from and why they can see that side. But like, there's almost like three that are, you know, when you're sitting there and you're talking or you're thinking about it, like I think what goes through your head is, okay, so I can kind of see where this is going to go. But for it to go where I think it's going to go, where they're going to get this guy not guilty, there's like three or four people who are going to, like, I'm really excited to see how they are going to be convinced, because like they are really stubborn. And obviously it goes from like the last four are really stubborn. So juror four, when they're discussing about the glasses on the eyes and stuff, and it like, you know, you start off the film not knowing anything about the scene of the crime or anything, then it drip feeds you little pieces of information. And it says about the woman, like, she wore glasses, but she never wore glasses in the court. She had the little little eye indentations for where the glasses are. And then you slowly start to like, oh, I think this is, I know where they're going with this. And then at the end, when he says like, what do you think? And then he kind of like, and you know, then he's going to say not guilty, but like, it's with all like the drama of like, not guilty. And you're like, yeah. It's just so like, but that whole bit where they're discussing like the glasses and like how you could see like 50, 60 yards or however many yards it was through a train that was going past at the same time. Like that the whole juror for like 10 minutes of that discussion was like my favorite, just because I think I was like, I don't know how they're going to convince this guy.
Yeah.
And obviously they, you know, in essence, they couldn't like make anything up really, because we didn't know any of the details, but like it was still exciting and still interesting. So I'm going with the whole juror four part.
Mm-hmm. I really do love that, because I think you said that yourself, that you're probably going to go back and watch this again sometime. And if for anyone who is looking to watch it, it's on free public domain movies, whatever.com. It's free. You can watch it, and you will not be, you know, worse off for watching a 90 minute masterpiece. I love that part with Dura 4 because that's the turning point of the film, I think. He is the one who isn't coming from it in a kind of a bigoted or letting their emotions dictate their beliefs. Like you touched on, he is Mr. Reason, he's Mr. Sensible, he's quite calculated, he thinks all through. And as soon as you realize that there's no real logical argument for it, I think everyone's kind of sold on it from that point. What about yourself, Liam? Were there any moments that really stood out to you? Because there aren't really scenes, you know? I think they're split up with edits, or maybe there's little timeouts everyone has when the arguments and the sweat getting too much. But yeah, what about yourself?
For me, one of the most impactful moments in the film is it's almost where they kind of take a stand in a sense to Jorah Ten, his absolutely horrific racism throughout the kind of 90 minutes. You know, he keeps alluding to it here and there. He'll say sly little racist comments here and there, and kind of, you know, straight away when he makes the first comment, whatever he says, you know, okay, he said he's voted guilty because of his bigoted views. Like that's kind of basically it. But he keeps going on and on, and then at one point, I don't know, it's near the end of the film where he kind of just goes on this horrific rant, but you're not focused on him. Everyone around the table stands up and walks away from him and turns away from him, and then he's just there on his own looking like a fucking idiot. And it's like, he's in that point, he's been completely humiliated. And he's also being shown to be what he is, you know, a racist, horrible idiot, mm-hmm. you know, who is basically using his bigoted views to vote against this poor guy who, you know, he may or may not have done the crime, whatever, but that he wasn't looking at the evidence. You know, he wasn't looking in his eyes. He said they're all the same. That's what he was saying. So in his eyes, he was going to vote guilty no matter the evidence. And that scene, and it lingers as well for a while, and then you just see like his jaded, you know, kind of it's so great. And he strolls over and sits down and puts his head on the table, and it's like, yeah, because he's embarrassed at that point. Yeah. Then he's been absolutely humiliated in front of all these other jurors, and I think that moment, I think it's really quite powerful in a sense as well, you know, considering that this was a Hollywood film as well from the 50s, where I don't suppose race or racism was highlighted very much. I don't know. I'm just guessing here. I don't imagine it was. You know, there's films that I've watched from back then where I've not really seen anything like that before, not in Hollywood anyway. So I think, like, in the sense of it being a film from the 50s as well, I think it becomes more impactful in a way that they're making a point of making this stance, you know, and I think that in itself is, it kind of makes the moment more powerful.
I love that you bring that up, because that's like the iconic moment from the film, for me anyway. It's the iconic moment from the film. And there's two things I kind of want to touch on about that is, first, you kind of see this guy be called out before. Like, there is, they don't ever really make any, you know, specific comment on it, but there's a juror who greatly identifies or relates to the kid who's been persecuted, and it's meant to be implied that he is also from a similar minority. There's also a kid who grew up in a slum, as they call it, which is also where the kid grew up, and the old dude, juror number 10, I think, has a particular disgust in that too. And there's moments where both of those other jurors kind of call him out on his bullshit individually, and nothing's really said about it. Other jurors come in and say, you know, stop this argument, and then, you know, probably cue the 5-minute timeout or whatever. But in that moment, you see everyone kind of take one stand against it, like you said, I know. And two things, another two things on that is, first of all, everyone coming together to make a stand is such a big part of this film, is that you don't really get anywhere with individual ignorance or individual, you know, what's the right term? You know, niceness, I'll use for want of a better word. It's almost midnight. You know what I mean, though? You don't really get anywhere unless it's collective, basically, is what I'm saying. And that doesn't just go for the whole the commentary on racism here, but it's also to do with the commentary on, you know, the judicial system, on prejudice, on everything this film talks about. And that moment kind of sums the film up for me. Another thing is quickly on that as well, is that when we first started talking about this, Liam, you said that it's not really an easy film. You think a film shot in one room would be dead easy to do. I remember in my second year of uni, they made us recreate this scene, and it's fucking impossible. Like, it sounds really easy because it looks almost like a stage play. Like, it was adapted from a play and a teleprompter play. And it works. Body language says everything that needs to be said. But just trying to film that, fucking hell, man. You need to give this guy some praise for a directorial debut. This is really impressive work. I guess on that then, because we'll touch on characters as we go, I want to kind of talk about some of the filmmaking here, because I think there's quite a lot of things that, quite a lot of simple little fundamental things that really work well throughout this film. And, you know, you've touched on the temperature getting hotter. I really love the weather in this, because there is a moment halfway through when the vote is tied at 6 guilty, 6 non-guilty. And you have, it's so good. There's a juror who is a salesman, and he has tickets to go to the Yankees game or whatever it is. And all he wants to do is just get the fuck out of the room and go to the baseball. He doesn't give a shit about anything that's going on, about the kid who's probably going to be killed if nothing happens, you know, because of this jury. And all he wants to do is go and watch his fucking little team get smacked up or win at baseball or whatever. And he decides to vote in favor of not guilty, despite the fact that he doesn't believe that. He doesn't care about that. He just wants to get out of there. And everyone calls him out on that. And what Sidney Lumet chooses to do, and I think this is so good, is have a little conversation by the window where the rain starts to come down. And that symbolizes so many other things. But on a literal level, you can't go to the baseball, it's been rained off. Stuff like that. There's so much fun in this film. And that's something that really stands out to me. And I want to know, were there any particular technical moments that stood out to you? I'll ask you that, Liam. What did you think about that?
Technically, the opening shot in itself is pretty cool, right? The kind of one shot to the doors, you know, it's like, it's almost telling you, like, here, we're going to drag you into this scenario, and we're going to take you on this journey. I kind of like that opening shot. Technically, I don't know, man. I don't know if I'm bright enough to go into technicalities of a film that's shot in one room. I don't know.
It's all right because there's so many little things that I think you wouldn't even realize or call them out as being like technical moments of brilliance or anything. But even the fact that there's 12 people in the room, probably at more or less all times, that means there's 12 different eye lines that people have to look to that, you know, for edit in the film. That's fucking ridiculous. Once again, as someone who shot films, 2 eye lines for 2 people is fucking hard. And then there's 12 of them in this, and that's your first film. And this guy, Sidney Lumet, was a guy who kind of made his name, first of all, as a play, like director of plays, and also as a director of television. He was an assistant director, I think, for a little while, but then was bumped up, and this was the first film he was given. And he does so many little kind of, I keep calling them fundamentals, because I suppose they are. And I love even stuff like the lighting in this film, how he frames characters and the lighting of it. You always see, it's really simple stuff, but you always see characters like Lee J. Cobb's juror, or the old racist juror played by Ed Begley, I think it is, or the salesman guy who, in my book, is the fucking worst of all of them. The way he frames them, they're always kind of like shrouded in darkness, or they're always kind of overpowering someone if they're being the aggressor, or overpowered by the rest of the jurors. And then you have also my favorite shot in the whole film is, there's a moment where I think it's kind of initially where Henry Fonda's making the case to the rest of the jurors, and he doesn't just frame them. In like a one shot. He frames them from the back of the table over the shoulders of everyone else. And he stands up and makes his point. And it just in that, you kind of see him. You see all you need to see about his character from that. I don't know. I really, really love that. But I guess if we're going to talk simple stuff, then let's talk about the dialogue, because that's the crux of the film. What did we think about that?
I feel like, pardon me, I feel like my general opinion, like I didn't notice it at the time, and it was just when I was thinking back about like just the film in general and like what it literally was and how, you know, it was literally a film set in one room over a span of, let's say, 6 hours or 8 hours or whatever it was. And I thought that was impressive. But then you kind of think back, well, what was impressive? Well, I'm glad you wanted to lay in with the technical stuff, because I was like, I didn't notice anything particular. But then, so what was impressive?
I didn't give you much technical stuff, to be honest, mate.
No, well, that's what I mean. Like,
the one shot was pretty good, you know.
No, well, that's like what kind of what I'm saying. It's like, you know, especially on your first go, it's like it's quite hard to tell, and especially if you're given a film that is like literally in one room. So I was like, okay, well, what was the thing that impressed me? Like, oh, well, I like the idea that it was so simple, but then it just must have been more than that. Well, okay, it's essentially just 12 people having multiple conversations around the room, and they only had 90 minutes to do it. So my general just view on the dialogue is just how sharp it was and I don't know, I think I just fall in love with like how these guys just used to speak and have like calm conversations. But then obviously, yeah, there was a few that would be a little bit heated, but I just think like how just crisp and how just so lean that every sentence, like we said earlier, and I don't want to repeat myself really, but every sentence just had to mean something, maybe not to the life or death of this guy who may or may not have done something, of the fact that we still don't know whether he did it, and that's almost a really good thing in itself. But the fact that everything meant something to someone's decision to do something, or someone's decision to say or feel one way or another. Mm-hmm. And that's like almost in like a very literal sense, the amount, as someone who is a writer of obviously not films, but I've got to do it for my living. Like the amount of times that he must have had, like the writers of the film must have had to kind of literally look line for line and be like, is this offering something somewhere? It doesn't have to offer like, you know, the ending of the film. It doesn't have to offer like a big cliffhanger. It just has to offer something about the character or about another character or about the situation. And it's just really like absolutely, you know, it's just crisp. It's brilliant. And that's kind of all I've got, really. I just thought, you know, this afternoon thinking about it, I was driving back from Liverpool and I was just like, it's just like almost as a writer, you're like, fuck, if I could be involved in something like that ever,
yeah,
that's what you're in it for, isn't it? And that's Bully. Kind of my opinion, really.
Go ahead,
I was just going to say, I just wanted to talk about all of, there's so many of the like gotcha moments, right, where it's like yeah. they'll kind of send you down one road and then bam, no, never mind, change your mind again. Mm-hmm. And one of the big ones that sticks out to me is it's a really tense scene as well, actually. It's following kind of a real heated argument or conversation or whatever you want to call it between Henry Fonda's character, juror number whatever he is, and the other guy, J Hobb.
Lee J Cobb. Yeah, man. Juror number 14, that one. Yeah.
Yes, 14 Angry Men. That's the name of the film. So yeah, they kind of have a heated conversation, and as I said earlier, like they're kind of, it's like the hit. They're both almost the hero and villain, and you get this scene where they're trying to talk about how the murder took place. In there was a kind of stab down into the chest, and Lee J. Cobb. Mm-hmm. So he has the knife and he's staring Henry Fonda right in the face, and they've had this heated argument, and you know, he has this knife and he could in that moment kill him, and he kind of goes to move to him, and then everyone stands up like, whoa, 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 whoa.
yeah.
And but then it's like, oh yeah, so you can easily stab down with that knife, so it must have been him. And then next minute, the the fellow who also grew up in a similar place to the man on trial, he goes on to say that, you know, this boy was with these flip knives, he was, you know, he knew how to use them. And the way you hold them, you can't stab down. You don't hold it like the way that they were describing. It's impossible to do it that way. If you were going to stab, you would almost stab up.
Yeah.
And then that minute you're like, oh, right, okay. So it couldn't have been him then. So you've gone in 1 minute from thinking, oh, okay, so you can easily stab down from there, because they were trying to say, oh, he's too short to get the angle that the murder took place. But then they prove you wrong, that no, you can do it that way. But the next minute, no way would he have been able to do it with this kind of knife. No way. It's a flip knife. I don't know what the hell they call it. And he was experienced with these knives. So he would have been able to go and like flick it up and go on, Luke, you can add to my brilliant theorizing.
No, sorry. I was, I only wanted to say one thing, and it's actually reminded me of something else that I really like when this type of thing happens, because it is like a kind of semi-gotcha, semi-like technical moment where, and it reminded me of, you know, when Inglourious Basterds were with the three and the three or whatever it is, when he's trying to obviously pretend to be a German, and it's like, and that's not something you're meant to know. And I like it in films where like things can make sense, or a lot of these arguments make sense, but like stuff you're not meant to know necessarily as an audience member, but like someone will come in and be like, oh no, like that can't be this because of this and this, and you go, oh, all right. Like it's just like it adds to it in a way that I can't really describe, but it just reminded me of the three in the bar in the Inglourious Basterds. Yeah.
Any excuse to talk about that scene, because that is like it's top three Tarantino scenes he's ever done for me, in my opinion. But quickly on that, I like that both of you touched on this, is because that kind of sums up where you sit as the audience, because you're constantly being won over and kind of flipping back and forth. And look, we've watched enough films in our lives and we know the kind of film language to know that as soon as we see Henry Fonda, he's our guy. He's wearing white. He's handsome. He's kind. He's like Tom Hanks before Tom Hanks came, except a bit more better looking. And you're kind of just on his team, right? So anything he says, you're kind of already agreeing with him. And there's a great quote from Sidney Lumet, who said something along the lines of, and I'm going to paraphrase because it is genuinely almost midnight now, that Henry Fonda was incapable of saying anything on screen that wasn't the truth. Just by looking at him, you know that he's a truthful, honest guy. He's the everyday, the good guy. And yeah, you, despite that, you're still kind of being won back and forth between these arguments, and you kind of flip allegiances sometimes. Did he do it? Did he not do it? And in the end, it kind of doesn't really matter, but what matters is the characters, and that they all kind of accept the now established importance and value of life. And that kind of leads us on to the last moment for me, really, which I think is so good, is the Lee J. Cobb speech about his kid, and he rips the picture up. I've watched this so many times now that lowers me. We used to have a cryometer. I think it was maybe out of 50. It's like those big strongman things where you swing the hammer and the bell goes up. That's me. I'm just bawling my eyes out earlier. I love that so much, man. What did you guys make of that kind of final moment?
I liked it. It didn't strike that much of me, really. It didn't strike that. I didn't find it that moving.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when he breaks down at the end, and it's kind of like, I don't know, is it another one? That's the final and the big realization moment of the final juror of the thing. And but I just it didn't strike with me. I don't mean that in like a I thought it could have been better. I just mean like literally, I didn't get that upset by it and stuff. So hopefully Liam can provide something a bit better on that one.
I just think with that character, when you consider everything he said prior to this. You know, when you think about what he said earlier in the film about his son, you know, he speaks about his son wimping out for want of a better phrase of a fight, And he said he was so furious with him, you know, that he could throw up. That is extreme levels of messed up. And then he said, so I decided to spend the next couple of years making a man out of him. And I did. And then next minute, I've not seen him in 2 years. Well,
yeah.
You've clearly not made a man out of him. You've made him hate you. And you resent yourself for that, which is why he is putting this kind of his kind of guilt and his shame onto this poor fella who is up for trial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's that moment that he rips it up where it is powerful, because that's a photo of him and his son. You know, that is family. That's his, you know, he loves his son unconditionally, despite the fact he's not seen his son in 2 years, despite the fact that his son wimped out of a fight. You know, I think in that moment he is, after he rips it up and he starts crying and he says not guilty, he's almost saying his son isn't guilty as well. Do you know what I mean? It's his son isn't guilty of being the man that he is.
Mm-hmm.
And this fella isn't guilty either. So he's kind of, it's almost like a release. And oh my God, the moment, and he's left on his own. But then Henry Fonda comes over and puts his jacket on him. He gives him his jacket.
I need to talk about this bit as well.
That's so good.
Because we've established that that Lee J. Hobson Shaw, or whatever his name is, he we've established that he, you know, he isn't really a good guy, but he's let his emotions and his kind of his own personal experiences really kind of cloud his judgment, and he's got a lot of misguided anger. And I think only on other watches you'll find him kind of sympathetic, because you know his full character, which you only get revealed at the end.
I think, like, when you as well, when you consider somebody says right at the start where he was like, oh, I had to call my dad sir, you know, there's no respect these days for fathers.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a throwaway line, you know, him saying, oh, I had to call my father sir. But then when you consider everything else,
yeah,
he probably had a pretty messed up relationship with his dad himself.
Bet you did. And not only that, he always talks about, you know, if we don't talk with these to these elders with respect. And then about 2 minutes later, he gets after the old guy.
Yeah.
He's constantly contradicting himself. And I find him such an interesting, well, first of all, character, but second of all, actor. Lee J. Cobb as an actor is incredible. And he plays the bad guy in the film called On the Waterfront from around a similar time by a director called Aaliyah Kazan. And that, like, he's just astonishing in that. But anyway, what I really love about that is that he clearly isn't a very emotionally intelligent person. Like, we talked about Henry Fonda being in that way. And if Henry Fonda were to put his arm around him, he'd probably get fucking knocked out. But he knows himself how to kind of to read other people and the kind of response that Lee J. Cobb's juror would appreciate and understand and be able to kind of almost relax into. And it is just helping him on with his coat, because that he's just moving forward now. He's just moving on. And that is a kind of closing moment for these 12 jurors, I think, is it is just kind of perfect. I've got maybe two more questions and then we'll wrap up. Quickly, very, very quickly on this one. What do you think's aged the best from this film? Obviously, it's a first-time watch for you guys, so I don't really mean in terms of where, you know, where it sits on rewatches, because you haven't had that. But I mean in terms of this film coming out in 1957 and watching it in 2021, you know, how do you kind of view this film through that?
In my opinion, and I'm glad that we got a chance to say this really quickly as well, just the fact that why people will have certain opinions, and some people will, not a lot of people will have their opinions swayed on basically evidence and truth and facts. Some people will, and then there's people, so there's almost like three sections in this jury. There's like people who sway quickly because, well, let's see, it's pretty straightforward that the evidence isn't there to, you know, whatever. Then there's a middle three, and then there's kind of the end four. And then there's a lot of the people who, it feels that, like, at least at the beginning, won't hear anything. Like, they won't change their opinion. They're too proud to change their opinion. And that is, you know, even hearing, like, evidence which I didn't think was completely, like, watertight. Like, you know, evidence for or against. But, you know, people won't listen to evidence nowadays. And I think that's, I don't know if that's aged that would probably say age well, I suppose, that particular element.
Yeah.
So I'd go with that, really.
For me, it's aged well in a bad way, in that it's still very relevant today, the subject matter. You know, you've still got severe prejudice in the world. You've still got corrupt detectives or coppers or whatever, you know.
Bent coppers.
Bent coppers, as... Yes, if you watch Line of Duty, you know what we're talking Sorry. About. yeah, corrupt coppers. Yeah, the prejudice, the racism is still all prevalent today. And, you know, death row in itself is, that is, you know, for me personally, I don't agree with it at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I know, it, obviously, in America, it's still, in some states, it's still legal. And there are people, innocent people, who will get wrongly convicted and have still have been killed. And are all, or they're waiting to be killed, and that in itself, you know, what is it, 63? Is it 70 years?
Almost.
It's still relevant in that sense. You know, for me, that's pretty fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, in that sense, it's aged well in a bad way. That mm-hmm. it is still relevant.
I think that kind of weight that it holds is why it's always going to be a film that people talk about, as kind of, when you think of classic movies, you don't really look further than this. Probably makes the top 10 of those, especially if you think about classic westernized movies. For me, I think there's quite a lot of things that have aged really well, but who wants to hear me rant about film and film history? Who gives a fuck about that? So quickly, the last question I want to go before your popcorns is, why aren't there really films like this anymore? Because I watched One Night in Miami recently, the film by Regina King, her directorial debut that came out, what, maybe 5 or 6 months ago. It's an Oscar kind of contender, maybe. And it's really similar, where not a lot happens. It's not based in one room. And it's kind of, I wouldn't ever call it a hangout film, but it's quite relaxed almost. And it's kind of comfort to talk about big, wide issues. And in this, it's kind of about religion and the, you know, the place that these four African-American celebrities, or, you know, influential figures kind of find themselves in this time. And I, you know, if 12 Angry Men is a film that you really, really loved and gravitated towards, I would recommend that wholeheartedly, because it really blew me away. There aren't really films like that made anymore, and I want to know why do you think?
Well, I've got to say, Connor, there is a film that is shot in an even smaller space than that one room, and it is Ryan Reynolds' horror film Buried, where he is subjected to a live burial for 90 minutes. He's got a mobile phone, he's got a lighter, he's got no time. He's running out of air. No, but seriously, that is a film. Yeah. I don't know why. Yeah. Why these? I don't know. Mm-hmm. I can only think that, you know, Hollywood has changed, and so has directors. I do struggle to think of films that are, you know, in the sense of, you know, in simple terms, shot like in, you know, set in one kind of room or two rooms or whatever. And, you know, I'm trying to think, other than the Ryan Reynolds horror flick Buried,
yeah.
I can't really think of many. And yeah, you mentioned One Night in Miami, which is, I guess, similar in that it's, is that in like one room? It's in like a hotel or something like that, right?
Well, it's more or less in a hotel, but the whole film is kind of based on discussion and debate. And that's the thing that I kind of care more about, where a lot is revealed through not just dialogue, or not, you know, through exposition, but actual just debate and real life chat kind of about themes. And you don't see that anymore, because I guess that's not what people care about right now. Especially nowadays, a lot of people want escapism, and that's probably the main reason behind it. But maybe more appropriate then, in maybe one or two words, you want more films like this? Because I think I do. I'm a sucker for stuff like this. Yeah.
No, but I think like, 70 years on and the film's still relevant. It's like, what, Criterion's number one best-selling DVD? I don't know. I just made that up. It just seems to always be... It's always being advertised by Criterion. It's always on sale. That's so amazing. I just imagine it's like their number one best-selling. I'm making it up. But like in 70 years' time, is Avengers Endgame going to be... Are we all going to be sat here, you know, are our kids or our grandchildren in 70 years' time going to be podding about Avengers Endgame, you know, as a classic film that, you know, was groundbreaking it won't be. It doesn't do anything interesting other than to entertain us, which in itself it's an achievement, but it's not interesting in the sense of like you can't have a deep dive into Endgame, can you?
And if anything's proved that, we definitely can.
We did.
Still being talked about on this podcast.
Yeah.
We covered 12 Angry Men. What film is directly linked to that? Let's talk about Avengers Endgame and the Ryan Reynolds film where he's buried underground.
No, but like Avengers Endgame, it is one of my favorite films of all time. But when I'm older, when I'm an old man, I'm probably not going to throw on Avengers Endgame. I'll probably throw on 12 Angry Men, which will be 100-something years old by the time I'm watching it. And I think that is in itself, maybe by the time that we are older, that they will start making films like this again. And I hope so. I really do hope so. I think there are some filmmakers that are trying to maybe shift the way that we kind of take in kind of entertainment through movies these days. Yeah. You know, there is more experimental films going on, right? I think like through like the 90s and the noughties, less so. I think we're slowly getting there.
I'm glad that you said you're probably going to watch this in when you're old and gray, because that bodes well for Popcorn's boys. It was both the first take for you guys, so I'll go first. In fact, I won't. I'll let you go first, Liam.
So I think just like last week, I'm going to have to give this film a solid 90 Popcorns.
Back-to-back
90s. Solid. I feel like I've spoken enough why I love this film so much. And
yeah, man.
Yeah, 90 seems very fair to me. You know, given it's my first watch, I imagine it probably will. It might even go to 100 after a few watches. Who knows?
I'm going to say, I think 89.
Just missed out on the big 90, but still, 89 is very respectable.
I think it'll get there, like Liam said. I think it'll get there over, like, you know, I said it could probably get into my top 10. Like, I don't say that, like, I just literally think, like, fuck me, I love that film so much, and I could easily, like, watch it, and it's had meaningful without, like, having to blow your brains out and understand stuff. So I think you can get there, yeah.
It's meaningful and it's 90 minutes and it's fun and it's enjoyable
and
it's interesting and it's important. And for all those reasons and many more, I'm going to give it 100. It deserves 100. I know. Luke celebrating for podcasters, there's arms in the air. You know what it is? It just has a real special importance for me, this film. And there's not one bad thing about it. Everything's aged well. It was the answer to my question, but none of you got that right. But don't worry about it. We'll work on it next week.
Oh, I thought Avengers Endgame was the answer, right?
Sorry. Yeah. If Avengers Endgame is the answer, what is the question? Anyway, moving on. So yeah, that's more or less us finished now. I want to talk quickly about what's coming next week, which I know is a first take for me, which I'm super excited about because I probably put off watching it for, I'd say, about 7 years. It's a first take for me. Is it a first take for any of you boys?
Yeah, me.
Luke Norden.
I know nothing about this film.
I've seen it before many moons ago.
Okay, Liam's seen it before. So it'll kind of be almost a 2.5 times first take for us. And that is, of course, Mary Hannon's American Psycho from 2000, which honestly kind of scares the shit out of me a bit. I've seen a couple scenes from it. I've seen the infamous Huey Lewis scene, which is kind of awesome. That's always made me want to watch it. And anytime Jared Leto was getting killed off, sign me up. I'm right there for that. So that was the episode. Thanks so much for listening. If you could do us one more favor, please drop us a follow on Twitter and Instagram at First Take Pod. You can let us know what you thought about the movie, recommend us some films, even some guests, or even just swing by and say hi. So until next week, I'll see you later. Goodbye.